Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Media and Monetization Panel. I'm Martin Ross, Global News Editor at Sport Business. Over the next 35 minutes, we are planning to get under the bonnet of media rights, consumption, streaming opportunities, along with D2C revenue sources in a digital world. To introduce my panel, starting with Andrew, just because I've got it first on my list, that's all. But Andrew's in the middle. He's managing director of FIBA Media, which is the joint venture between the International Basketball Federation and DAZN, which was Perform, which was set up to handle production and rights distribution across FIBA's premium events. Directly beside me is Tanya Heimlich-Ningyen, who's director of client services at Two Circles as of May. Tanya spent 14 years at BCW Sports, which was TSE Consulting in a previous life, leading member of the team running the sports unit, focusing on communications, public relations with IFs and host cities. And on the far right is a very famous face in these parts. It's Jack McGill, CEO of QTV, Scotland's leading broadcast production outside broadcast facilities provider, also works with various international federations, continental federations, national federations, and along with production, Jack is well-versed advising rights holders on digital strategies and monetization. And didn't write that himself, actually. I wrote this, believe it or not. We will be running a poll on slido.com during the panel, which I think is above me. Yes, it is. Ben's put up. You can see it there, but for the benefit of the guys on the stage as well here, we're asking you which revenue streams you expect to show the greatest growth or the smallest contraction over the next few years. Broadcast rights, other media rights, hosting fees, ticketing, sponsorship and advertising, merchandise, or OTT subscriptions and pay-per-view. I wanted to kick off, Andrew, perhaps with you, given, I suppose, where the broadcast market is after years of uplifts in various countries due to market dynamics, if you like. We've seen fees plateau or shrink with only sort of a handful of properties showing growth. For your position as a rights distributor, you're kind of at the coal face, if you like, of distributing rights. I wonder what your experience was of that now, and also your views on the future opportunities around consumption patterns and going D2C, which obviously you're also very involved in.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for the introduction, Martin. Very, very enjoyable to be here with you all in Glasgow. I'll speak broadly across sports rights trends at the moment, and probably where they sit very much depends on who you are. There's particularly probably less so in the top forum we're at here today, but certainly within the dedicated sports media rights conversation, there is a lot of chatter, particularly in Europe, of depressed media rights valuations or real challenges that are coming up in the next 5 or 10 years. I think that probably, whether or not you believe that narrative, is very much depending on who you are, whether you're a top-tier rights holder, mid-tier, or one that's sort of really in the nascent space, and probably also the territory that you're in, to be honest, too. Because if you look at the States, for instance, the NFL just sold their new package of rights for, I think it was, $10 billion a year over 11 years, plus another handy little $2 billion a year from Google for what they call their Sunday ticket project, property. You've also got the NBA, who are in the market for their rights relatively soon. They're projecting there or thereabouts $7.5 billion per year for their media rights. So they're not insubstantial figures whatsoever. So certainly there are certain parts of the media rights market, and particularly for top tier rights holders, where things are looking very, very healthy indeed, and certainly where that pie of media rights value feels like it is in a very, very good spot. Obviously, probably where you've seen a little bit of contraction are particularly there's been a few of the domestic football rights holders that, because of whether or not their properties losing really key players, or alternatively certain things happening in their market, so France is a good example of that, are just not hitting the valuations that they're used to. But I think it's a long way from being doom or gloom, or that there is going to be some monumental collapse in the media rights market. I think some will continue to profit, and profit very, very handsomely indeed. Others may not necessarily continue to achieve the same valuation they have. for FIBA, we probably sit in an interesting space. We're fortunate that for our last World Cup, for instance, we had broadcast deals covering around 190 territories, so almost the entire world. And we probably sit in one of those three spaces in a range of different territories. There are certain parts of the world, the Baltics, the Balkans, China, certain other parts of Southeast Asia, parts of Latin America, where we are an absolute must-have property and generate really quite significant rights fees, particularly comparable to a lot of other international federations. There are other places where we're probably a really nice to have property, and a lot of that is sometimes driven by which superstars are coming up in a particular national group. So, for instance, my home country, Australia, we've currently got around 11 or 12 NBA players, a really, really good group. Basketball is booming there. The national team's doing very well. So it's probably sort of flitting between that first or second group. And then there's others where basketball is just not necessarily a top-tier property and the national team is not necessarily in a great state. We have to take different methods to try to market there. And we're fortunate that particularly for our major events, we get to call on some of the biggest names in world sport. You know, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Luka Doncic, LeBron James has played in FIBA events before, Steph Curry. So names that certainly in the basketball world, conscious that we're in the UK, which is not always the biggest basketball nation, despite you now having been subjected to not only Slam Ball, the Oklahoma City Thunder, and now FIBA in the space of an hour. So good to see some basketball domination here this afternoon. But it's very much something that we will market those really, really top-tier global superstars as part of our rights play. So we're in an interesting space. We're going to the rights market for our next cycle relatively soon. So this is the first time post the last sales, which happened during COVID. And even then, we found the property very resilient and essentially increasing quite healthily in a lot of markets.
Tanya, I wonder if we could drill down a bit on the sort of consumption and the numbers that underpin these rights fees, and whether it's growth or whether they're stagnating, but the strong consumption that there still is on linear and digital, but also, you know, in your experience, the importance of owning that D2C relationship, perhaps on top of your rights fee or in place of.
Thank you, Martin. Thanks for the intro, and also very happy to be here. So we're talking about. If we're talking about that D2C relationship, we have to look a little bit back at the history. Andrew just kind of mentioned a few, you know, current rights coming up, and some are doing well and some are not. But if you look back, if we go back a little bit in history in 2016, 2018, you know, things were going really, really well. We had rights holders were paying whatever, broadcasters were paying whatever rights holders kind of wanted. You look back in the last 5 years, sort of 2019 onwards, it's kind of flattened out. And you know, to your point there's some that are doing really, really well and some not so well. Look at football here, especially in a more mature market like Europe. We have the Premier League, they've just re-signed, but it was a flat. It was not increased at all. The French leagues also had no takers coming in. They valued themselves at 800 million. Nobody came to the table for that. So, but you start to look and say, okay, but there are some entities that are doing really, really well, and what do they have in common? You look at Formula One, for example. Look at the Champions League, for example. What are they doing right now? And that is audience growth. That means fans. It means that owned relationship that that you just mentioned, that D2C. They're investing in their fans. They're investing in getting to understand what their fans want. For us at Two Circles, it's very much, we like to say this data, this first-party data, is the new currency. By knowing who your fans are, what they consume, what they like, what they don't like, where they consume and how much are they interacting with your brand, your product, you become, let's say, that owner of that first-party data. You know what they will eventually buy, and you can actually use that as currency when you sit down and talk in your commercial negotiations later on. You're actually able to say that our fans have this value. It's not just because of supply-demand as it was back in the day. It's actually saying, you know what, I have a fan. My fan is worth X amount of money. Therefore, my rights are actually worth X amount of money now. So I can prove, based on the data, based on our own party data, that our this first-party data from our fans that we talk to on a day-to-day basis, and we have X amount of data points per day, per year, per in the last 5 years, and therefore we know that that projection and that forecast in the next cycle will be actually worth maybe 10% more, 15% more, whatever the case may be.
And I mean, some of the numbers we're throwing about here will be, you know, irrelevant to many smaller rights holders, or, you know, a rights fee at all will be irrelevant to some rights holders. So I mean, Jack, I'm particularly interested in asking you, you know, given your experience working with some of the lower tier rights holders and that puzzle that there is in the digital space that they try and solve, do you still feel there are great opportunities out there in pay-per-view subscription, OTT monetization? Are they being taken? Or if you're a niche sport, what do? Do you go high price point, exclusivity, small pond? But if you do that, how are you then growing your engagement? How can you do both?
Yes, I think there are opportunities. I think that second and third tier sports that don't really command rights fees in a global marketplace have to almost reinvent the way they think about their strategy. So the first thing is, there is a way to engage with international broadcasters. So that's the first thing. But you need a proper strategy. You need to understand you're not going to make any money out of it, and you need to invest in the consistency and sustainability with which you service those broadcasters with content. So that starts first and foremost with getting your news highlights correct. So making sure that your news agencies, like, you know, Euronews, for example, if you're servicing somebody like EBU or news agencies, are getting consistently produced and formatted and presented information about your event on a regular basis. And when they start to pick up on that content, then you will find that the production elements within a broadcaster will start to get more interested in what it is they're talking about and the news stories about their national athletes that are emerging from those lower tier sports. So then you need to make sure that you've got, at the very least, a good highlights program that's coming out the back of that. And again, you're probably giving it away. You're not doing, you know, you're not going to be able to command a fee for this, but you need to make sure that that programming, again, is consistent, produced a good standard, that the quality of competition has integrity and credibility, you know, to it. And then the next step up from that is live. And you could spend years producing live and not get paid anything for it. But at some point, you'll reach a tipping point of engagement with international broadcasters where they will start paying fees for that. And then all of a sudden, you've got the opportunity to monetize that. And I think we've seen that very successfully with World Archery over the last 5 to 10 years. You know, they've grown their global broadcast audience from about 20 million to 280 million, and they now command rights fees. But they've done it with a very, very specific strategy that they've followed absolutely to the letter and have expected all in their supply chain to follow it to the letter as well. So I do think there's an opportunity there for rights holders to do that. And that doesn't just go for sports federations. That goes for any event organizer. So anybody who has a regular event, whether it's in sport or otherwise, it's about building the consistency of your content, how you distribute it, what you say about it on a regular basis. I think on top of that, you then have an opportunity in an OTT space, a direct-to-consumer space, where you can have your own platform. And to your point of whether you go with the big pool or the small pond, my thinking over the years of doing this has evolved to now be in a place where I cannot see any alternative to a high price point and a small pond. The people that are going to engage with your sport, whether you're field hockey or whether you're slam ball, or whether you're, handball, let's say, for the sake of argument, triathlon, let's pick a few kind of mid-tier federations. The people who are going to pay money to watch that are already invested in your sport. They're already there. You've already got them. They're engaged. They're probably engaged because they play the sport recreationally, or they have family members or friends who play it as well. But they're already there. That's whatever OTT platform you're going to set up is not the entry point into that sport for the casual observer, for the casual viewer, or for a new fan. It's for people that are already engaged. So whether you put £1 between them and the content, or you put £10 between them and the content, they're going to pay it. And the elasticity of that model is that although you will lose subscribers the higher that price point goes, you will lose them at a slower and slower rate the higher you go, because they already value your sport. So if you're going to give them a quality product to watch, then you need to inject some value into that as well and charge them appropriately for it.
And, I mean, FIBA is one of these sort of interesting federations that's doing both. It is accruing strong rights fees in certain markets, but there's also, you know, aggressively going at D2C in dark markets where there aren't deals. The Courtside 1891, which is FIBA's platform with which Two Circles is working, which I would kind of, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Andrew, would kind of describe it as a kind of hybrid platform of, yes, it's live for premium, and you'll pay a price for that, but there's also a free registration. And the fact that the free registration is a registration is, seems really important, because you need to get them into your ecosystem to cross-sell with tickets and merchandising. I wanted to ask you about that, and then maybe I'd quite like to ask a follow-up actually about the NBA app, but maybe... Okay.
My brain can only handle one question at a time, so let's just stick with that one. First one. So thankfully, no need to correct you there, Martin. You've summarised it to the point where it's almost pointless me answering this question. No, so Courtside 1891, and just for I'm conscious that not everyone here knows what we're talking about when we say OTT or D2C and the like. Effectively, it's a fancy way of saying that we have a web, an app product in which we deliver content that can be accessed directly by consumers rather than having to go through your traditional sort of set-top television box or anything like that. It all gets mashed about in different hybrid forms now, but that's essentially what we're talking about. So as Martin's mentioned, in the vast majority of territories across the world, as much as we sell what we largely call exclusive broadcast rights, we also retain the right to make available live broadcasts of our major events via a subscription platform, which is the Courtside 1891 platform. Just go back to what Jack said, we think actually the price elasticity of that is pretty high. If people are coming to that service and they want to watch the FIBA World Cup, FIBA Eurobasket, the Women's World Cup, or any of the other properties that are on there, they're probably highly invested international basketball fans and they will have a propensity to pay a premium amount. But there are different layers to that. We have multiple entry points of whether it is very, very short form highlights that don't actually require a subscription full stop, and that is our possibly futile attempt to try to drag people away from social media platforms and to actually watch them on something that we own. Then you have a second tier, which is, I guess, more of an extended highlights proposition, which does require a registration component, because it's not just to call this a revenue generating activity would be completely missing the point. It is very much as well about the platform that has allowed FIBA to not only invest in user data infrastructure and to exploit that in, and I say exploit in a very, very friendly way, but to do that in addition to it being somewhere where we have a subscription. So us actually generating registrations from basketball fans is a very helpful thing for our broader marketing activities. So it's very much a multiple touch points, and I guess the other, whether it's certainly interesting in my world, maybe not necessarily for everyone in this room, but with Courtside 1891, one of the reasons why we haven't just branded it FIBA TV or FIBA Plus or some other inane name of similar nature is because we're bringing in basketball content from across multiple leagues that do not sit under our umbrella, for instance. So we have highlights from 7 or 8 of the biggest basketball competitions in the world. We have live basketball from the Basketball Champions League, the East Asian Super League. We will be bringing more on as we go. We have live stats and data from virtually every professional league in the world. So it's an international federation play, but one that is very much trying to service the broader basketball fan market.
Before I ask about NBL, I'll let you have a quick rest. And Tanya, on that, on Courtside 1891, I mean, maybe you could explain a little bit how Two Circles supports FIBA in this, but also how it's indicative of a rights holder having to now work so much harder than they used to know their audience, to know the traffic, and make sure all these kind of monetization opportunities are aligned.
Yep. Well, let me first take the point about how IFs and, let's say, rights holders in general have to work harder. You know, I talked a little bit before about the market, how the market's changing. Andrew mentioned it's contracting now, which means that we need to start thinking a bit more innovatively, right? Because the market has changed, there's more it's more challenging. And what happens when it's more challenging? There's more competition. And I'm not just talking about sport to sport. I'm not talking about FIBA versus volleyball versus football versus... I'm talking about entertainment. The entertainment industry is now a competitor to the sports industry, whether we like it or not. I mean, we're looking at fans, and if you look at the fans right now, even ourselves, people here... If you're on your phone, you can easily switch between the scores and between Netflix and between, you know, something else. Something else is capturing your mind at any given moment, and it's the same thing for the younger generation of fans coming up and the fans here in this room. And so when I say you have to work harder, I mean that we need to start thinking more innovatively, and that's exactly what FIBA, for example, is doing right now with this courtside. It's not a... let's say a FIBA TV where we're just posting things and putting things on and just... a little bit of copy-paste and taking the highlights, it's actually creating a hub for basketball fans internationally to go. And this is going to be that central place where they want to collect not just fans interested in their products, but all basketball products. And that's, I think that's something that's, very, very differentiative. And that's where I think IFs and rights holders in general, hosts need to also think, how do you capture and keep and engage fans? It's one thing to get them on in maybe using your product, but how do you keep them there? How do you make sure that they spend most of their time there rather than being distracted by another type of event product out there? So I think when I say, you know, again, going back to what can you do to be more work harder, it's not harder, it's just harder and smarter a little bit too, using innovation. And again, I have to say what we do with FIBA, it's really just trying to do something a little bit different, making sure that we use technology, making sure that we open up and keep bringing in new ideas to capture and to keep audiences.
And I suppose a question for all of you, really, but on that topic of Courtside 1891, at which Andrew's explained a kind of multi-property offering in many ways, but has a really interesting tie-up with the NBA app to try and tap into their audience instead of vice versa. I wonder, sort of as a panel, if you can think of other federations and rights holders who've done similar and actually thought, well, hang on a minute, well, let's actually work together. Publishers do it, broadcasters do it, Netflix and Sky will get together with cross-promotion. Are rights holders doing enough of this, or are we very much staying in our lane, saying, you know, these are our rights and our property and this is our platform?
FIH, which is the International Federation for Hockey, do something similar with NAGRA, who are their app provider. So they have provided the umbrella app, watch.hockey, which is available to all of the national associations, not even just national associations, but if you take in Australia, I believe, I might be wrong, but Queensland Hockey, New South Wales Hockey, have their own channel within the FIH app. And so that allows them the opportunity to cross-promote each other's leagues. So if you are a hockey fan, when you log on to the app, it will tell you everything that is live from whatever part of the world it is. And each of those channels has the opportunity to then monetize in whichever way is appropriate for their audience. So they can be ad-driven, they can be subscription-based, they can do different pay-per-view models. And obviously, they've got their own sponsorship and their own wrapper, that their own skin that they put onto to their channel to make it brand appropriate for them. I think that, don't ask me if it makes any money or not. I don't know the answer to that. Closely guarded secret, I'm sure. But the point of that is that what FIH have done is created something that embraces the whole pyramid of their sport. So it can be an entry point for somebody that's just coming into the sport and is maybe looking for inspiration, where they can access, in the dark markets anyway, the top level international competition. But all the way through the pyramid, they can see what the different stages are. The quality then of what content is within those channels is up to those individual local rights holders. And that can vary, but at least it has a core theme through it that is universal for everybody that's on the app. If it makes money or not, and we can talk about whether OTT actually makes money for those that provide the OTT service as opposed to the rights holder, I don't know, but if there's an obligation on IFs to help serve the whole pyramid of their sport, then that's a really interesting way to do it.
Do you want me to touch on the NBA? Yeah, sure. So I won't go into huge detail. So just to explain, this is so our courtside 1891 service for the FIBA World Cup, which just took place in the Philippines, Indonesia, and Japan earlier this year, and also for the coming years, we have a deal with the NBA where that product will be carried, so to speak, on the NBA app. So effectively, you can subscribe, you can watch the same content, and you can all do it from within the NBA app and through their League Pass service. And there are very, very, very good reasons why we've done this, and ones that are mutually beneficial for ourselves and the NBA. For lack of a description, we plug a content hole for the NBA. So because of the way that the international windows work, when the FIBA World Cup takes place, there is no NBA, and the NBA has a lack of content when going from NBA draft through to NBA Summer League process. For us, as much as we have a really high volume of content compared to most international federations, because we cover both the global events but also the regional events as well, we still can't be a 12-month-a-year proposition, just because of the fact that players are playing in domestic leagues, which is part of the reason why we brought in that additional content to Courtside 1891. But also, we know that probably the most highly engaged basketball league in the world is the NBA. So us being able to have our FIBA content through Courtside 1891 on a product that millions and millions will visit on a weekly basis is a very, very good thing, both for us from a revenue perspective and from a visibility perspective.
I wanted to, briefly move to some technologies before we open up and also check in the poll. I see that ticketing is doing particularly badly, actually, which is interesting. On new technologies, be it, I suppose, in venue, we can talk about that and how that whole fan experience is developing. But then also, I suppose, Jack, this is in your wheelhouse of production. The lower barriers to entry there are now for a smaller federation to... with remote production costs coming down, with AI camera technology, it's now very easy to, you can be in a position to get that exposure. Are these costs coming down and abilities actually now making it easier to monetize that space from the rights holder?
You can have it better, faster, or cheaper. You can have two of those, but you can never have all three at the same time. It's a balancing act, isn't it? There was a big drive towards companies like Pixelot and Keymotion a few years ago with automated cameras. There is a sacrifice in quality that you make with that, but can it help you at the base of the pyramid of your sport create a way for engaging club hockey players or club cricketers or club basketball players to... start on that journey towards, a much bigger, more monetizable platform? Yeah, absolutely. Can you do that cheaper now? Yes, absolutely. You can. But you have to always be conscious of your brand values, the story you're trying to tell about your sport, that, the credibility of the coverage, the credibility of the competition, and make sure that whatever level of production you're putting in is appropriate for the competition that the viewer is watching. I think it's quite interesting, and ticketing's quite interesting. I think, there's a really interesting Scottish company fan base at the moment that are engaging with a lot of football and rugby clubs in particular, who have an app, so the ticketing is all through an app. And I find it really interesting that you could pull together some of those different strands of event organization. Why, for example, on your ticketing app should you not get video content? If you've bought a ticket to be at an event, one of the things that you miss instantly is the ability to watch any of it in television or to be able to see a replay, particularly if you're at Hampden Park, by the way, watching the Scotland national team, where they show you literally nothing in the venue. Although some would say that's possibly a good thing, but, why can't you bring those two things together with an element of media rights, an element of sponsorship, and put it on the same app through which you're getting your ticketing, through which you're ordering your F&B in venue, and it becomes a much more holistic, experiential part of the process. That, to your point a minute ago, relies on everybody lowering their own barriers and not just sitting in their own silos, putting their egos to one side, realizing that they're just one part of it. They're not the most important part in the room. They're just a partner in the room. And possibly being more open-minded about where those media rights opportunities might be, where those content opportunities might be, and where those technology opportunities might be.
I mean, there's lots of opportunities within OTT and pay-per-view, but I looked at 56% of the audience here. It is bundled in with other media rights as well, but it's certainly good news for the rights holders sitting on the panel anyway. I wanted to open up to any questions you might have for any of our three here, if anybody's got wants to catch a big cube. Do we have a cube? Where's the cube? We've got two here.
This I really want to see this throw.
I was going to say, this cube's giving us some of the best content.
I know.
Well, I'm Bjorn from Innovation Norway. I just wondered if you have any thoughts about, you say that people will pay if they are interested, but a lot of people can't pay. In Norway, for instance, if you're going to see Viktor Hovland, if you're going to see Erling Haaland play, you have to pay £200-300 a month. And that means that a lot of people don't have access to these channels. And I think when I grew up, I could see everything for free. So I got hooked, and I wanted to pay now. But my son, he starts to, and his friends, they don't look at sport that way. They look at small things on TikTok to see the goals. But I think a lot of people have never seen them played live. And in 2-3 generations, where will we then be?
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, there is nobody from a public sector broadcaster up here to answer your concern. Unfortunately, I think for a lot of sports here in the UK, they've realised that the BBC is no longer the answer. You know, it's not the goose that's going to lay the golden egg for them. And they're going to have to come up with their own solution, either individually or collectively as a group of national governing bodies. The one thing I would say, going back to my first point about how you engage with broadcasters, is the first rule of thumb with broadcasters is make it as hard as possible for them to say no. So they are inherently themselves short on resources, short on time and patience. They are fundamentally lazy. So you have to put it on a platter for them, which means the venue that you choose for your sport needs to look good, okay? It needs to be dressed not necessarily for the people who are in the venue. It needs to be dressed for the broadcast cameras. It needs to, you know, where your audience sits needs to be right in the eye line of the cameras. Where your branding looks best needs to be in the eye line of the cameras. So you've got to make it look as good as possible. You then have to get the pictures out as you need to put in the appropriate level of production, as we've discussed. You then need to get it out in the most efficient, cost-effective manner for you, but also for the broadcaster. And you need to keep offering it to them over and over and over and over again. And eventually, if you follow that trajectory that I laid out, it will become impossible for them to say no. But as long as it costs them money, taxpayers' money, in the case of the BBC here in the UK, and there are any barriers to them, they will simply say no. And I think one of the ways in which UK sports could get cleverer about this is by working more closely together to align their national championships more effectively, so that if you take Paul Bristow's model of the European Championships as an example, you're bringing all of those sports together and making them something that collectively is too good to turn down for a national broadcaster. And that's where you start that generation on that journey of free-tier content. You then need to do all the TikTok stuff and everything else around it. Of course you do.
Clipping. Absolutely. We don't have time to talk about it.
That's a long answer, and I apologize to my fellow panelists for dominating that question. But I care about it as much as you do, and I'm in the privileged position that I can take my son. I have, you know, the resources to take my and the access to take my son to sports events and my daughter to sports events, and they are hooked. Yeah. But not everybody does. You're quite right. So
we've got one. Sorry to cut you off, just because we've got only got a couple of minutes. But there's a gentleman up here that'd like to ask a question.
Gee, that's a long throw.
I think this needs a Finn Russell pass.
Hi, this is for Jack. You're going to get it. You said about using apps, okay? One thing that people have to understand is most of the venues in the world cannot have the capacity for the mobile network operators or capacity for your Wi-Fi.
Yep.
And also, when you're using apps and you're using Bluetooth or any ticketing systems, it's a massive investment.
It is.
In Doha, we had 600 Bluetooth beacons per venue, multiple mobile cells, and a Wi-Fi system that cost a lot of money. So it's a good thing, but the cost of that for any normal sport would be actually too much.
So my answer to that at the moment is that private 5G networks will be the multi-use solution to in-venue connectivity. So there's a very good spin-off company from this university called Neutral Wireless who create pop-up private 5G networks. So it's not linked to the telcos, it's not linked to the cellular network. It is a private network, and you can stack everything from your broadcast cameras to your FPOS positions for F&B and merchandise to your ticketing, all within a shared spectrum that should, in the fullness of time, be bookable through whoever your Ofcom equivalent is. And that will end up being the low-cost alternative.
Yeah, I know Neutral Wireless because I was in Marseille with them, so I know what they're doing a lot next year. The problem is for the fans and people turn up with the mobile devices with the tickets on them and doing that. The amount of money it was spent in Doha just to make the mobile phone network work for some really good fan engagement software was phenomenal.
Yeah,
we had hundreds and hundreds of antennas installed. So that's the thing, though. So we can get too much with technology and it costs too much. So it's just something, a warning to folk, because we always forget how much it costs.
Yeah, not to stop that fascinating discussion, but I think it was just not to take control of the conversation.
No, just
Martin,
if you wrap up,
coming back
then we're
to
done.
That public service question up there, I actually would be very keen to hear Tanya's point on Two Circles have done some, and I say this as not as a partner, but as someone who's genuinely interested in this stuff and genuinely cares about youngsters getting access to content, have done some really fascinating research about fan development, and particularly in younger age groups. So I think that would be a great segue to jump on that question.
Yeah, go for it. Just
all right, sorry. Last comment here. We actually, I wanted to say to that point, we did do a really fascinating study and analysis using data points across several nations, trying to find the right, when does a fan become a fan? And actually, the age made by 14, just to your point for your son, you know, and actually to all the hosts, event hosts here and rights holders, if you're able to capture the attention of young fans between the ages of 8 and 14, they are more likely to be engaged with the sport throughout the rest of their life, almost 200% more. They're more likely to spend, meaning merchandising, ticketing, et cetera, all throughout their life. Again, almost 200% more likely, depending on which country they're in. And they're more, almost 200% more likely to be more active. And that, I think, as host cities and government officials, public sectors, that is absolutely fantastic because it also reduces your costs eventually on healthcare, et cetera, but actually you have a more active population.
And it's a very positive place to end. Thank you very much, Tanya. Excellent. Good wrap. If you could join me, ladies and gentlemen, in thanking our panel for a really interesting talk. Thank you.